today with Dr. K. I'm Dr. K. Wise Whitehead here again to have another conversation with you about some of the stories that matter. Folks, it is, as always, an honor and a privilege and a delight to be with you on this day as we begin to take stock of what has happened this month, because we're winding down to the end of Black History Month. Make a note. We're not winding down to the end of celebrating and focusing on Black history. We're counting down to the end of Black History Month. And even though we have had a month that has been fraught with news coming out of Washington that's been very disturbing, we're still dealing with the aftermath of Donald Trump's presidency. We're still dealing with the aftermath of the failed insurrection. We're still dealing with the fact that Joe Biden and Sister Kamala Harris are still getting up to speed. We're in that midpoint where we're trying to figure out, how do we go forward from here? What does it mean at this point in 2021? What does it mean to be Black in America? What does it mean to fight the same battles over and over again and feel like there's no relief in sight? What does it mean that we are coming out of a time when all we've been talking about is freedom and justice? All we've been talking about is reparation and restoration. All we've been talking about is how this country can come together, and yet and still, Black folks are being killed at unimaginable numbers by the police. We still have Black folks being arrested for simply living their lives. I had an opportunity yesterday to be on a panel for the Reginald F. Lewis Museum. I moderated this panel talking about Capitol riots, talking about racism, talking about the future of America. And I was joined by activist DeRay McKesson, who pointed out that despite the marching that took place in 2018, despite the work that we did with Black Lives Matter that I call 1.0, despite all of that, what we're still seeing is that last year, police officers killed more unarmed Black people last year, according to DeRay McKesson, than in 2018. So we got to talk about, where do we go from here? Is it time for revolution in the Black community? Is it time for a revolution? Now, don't get me wrong here. Don't get it twisted. I'm not talking about overthrowing the government. I'm not talking about some type of failed insurrection. I'm talking about making a plan for how to move forward as a country, making a decision about how we want to live in this country. Finally, once and for all, saying that we're no longer going to take it anymore, that we're not going to allow ourselves to be pushed around, to be ignored, to be overlooked, to be taken for granted. We are saying for our children to be free, for our children to live in a country where they can walk and not be afraid. We're saying for our children to understand that their life and their lives collectively do matter. It's going to take us doing something different. It's going to take us pushing back against the system and standing up. It's going to take, I would argue, a revolution. Is it time for revolution? Interesting, folks. Interesting conversation today, because we have been celebrating 28 days of Blackness, asking the hard questions about who we are and who we want to be in this country, really wrestling with our experience in America and wrestling with our future in America. And maybe what is needed once and for all is a revolution. Maybe what is needed is what I heard a gentleman on the panel say yesterday, Lieutenant Colonel Maurice Banks, I believe his name is. He said that we don't need to look to reform the police department. We need to look to blow it up. In other words, he's saying that the only way we can get free, the only way we can change this country, the only way we can force America to wrestle and reckon with its past, the only way that we can figure out who we are and who we want to be, the only way that that can be done is blowing up the system as it stands. Are you prepared to do that? Are you ready to blow up this system and say we are going to take a stand to bring about some real change in America? We're going to push back until freedom and justice have come. We're going to, as a community, here on the 22nd, as we are making our way to the last few days of Black History Month 2021, we are saying we're going to do something different, something radical, something that may change the future of this nation. And we're not doing it for ourselves. We're doing it for our children. And really, really, hear me out, we're doing it for the children of our children. Let's be clear. When we talk about making a change, when we talk about looking to shift things radically, I know that my sons, my boys, aren't going to benefit from this. Why? Because they're already 18 and 20. Like, they're already caught up in the system. They're already trying to figure out where they go next. They're already just about done with high school. I'm not talking about blowing things up for them. I'm talking about blowing things up for the children of our children, doing it for the generation to come. Let me tell you why I'm focusing on the children of our children and why that's so important. Earlier today, I had an opportunity to have a one-on-one conversation with Dr. Lawrence Brown, the author of The Black Butterfly. We had him on the show a couple of weeks ago talking about his new book. I sat down with him, and one of the things that Dr. Brown said is that if you go back, Baltimore City is ground zero for racist, apartheid housing policies. We are ground zero. 110 years ago, Baltimore City enacted the first racialized housing laws that permanently, at least in the short term permanently, banned Black folks from buying houses in certain neighborhoods. Why do I say permanently? We're like, well, it's different today. Well, today, if you've been part of the generation that came after that, you don't even have the money to move into these communities. Like, we're watching as Baltimore City, which is really a microcosm of America, Baltimore City has set up over 110 years an American apartheid system. That's what Dr. Brown said. He said, this is Baltimore apartheid. And what we're seeing is we're watching it play out in real time. We're watching what it means to be Black and economically challenged in Baltimore City. We are watching how it is that we cannot move forward in this city because of the historical racist policies, practices, systems, and procedures that have been in place. That part of what happens here in Baltimore City is they linked our development, our neighborhoods, our schools, even the environment that we live in as Black folks in this city, they linked it to what we call racist housing policies. And because of that, they end up setting up a system where the white L, which are the communities that are predominantly populated by white folks with money, that cuts down through the spine of the city, and then you make a left, go east when you get down the Fells Point. The white L has had their life expectancy rise because it's been supported by neighborhoods designed to support good health. You live in communities where you can walk to the grocery store. There's green space. There are trees everywhere. Take a trip through the white L. Like, the next time you want to go on vacation, here's what I'm telling you. Don't go outside the city. I'm just saying. Don't go to Annapolis. No, no. Don't head down to Negro County and PG County, which is what my friends in PG County call it. Don't go to MoCo. Don't go to HoCo, right? Don't go to HackCo. Don't. Take your vacation time and say, little boys and girls, Rashida and Rashad, Jose and Jimenez, we are going to take a vacation and drive through the White L of Baltimore City. Let's see what's happening over in the White L. And what you will find, that when you hit the top of the White L and you ride through those trees, I mean, you're like in another country. I mean, it's beautiful. I've done it. I did it so you didn't have to. The communities that are within the White L were designed to support and nurture and sustain good health. So you have access to fresh fruits and vegetables. You have access to green space so you can take your kids on a walk to the park. You have trees on your block and trees populating your backyard. You have big backyards you can spread out that when you were quarantined at home, you just went in the backyard and you were fine. In contrast, the neighborhoods in the Black Butterfly, and that's that population of folks that sprinkle around the White L. In contrast, those communities were designed to promote and to sustain poor health. So you see a lot of concrete jungles, can't get to playgrounds, don't have any grocery stores. They are fresh food deserts and fast food swamps. It's where you have to go get your groceries from the corner store. Or when you go down to the corner store, as I have done, I'm not telling you what I heard, I'm telling you what I know. I walked through the neighborhoods. You remember I took Mikkel with me for Mornings with Mikkel. We walked through the neighborhoods. We were able to buy a cup of sugar, buy one egg out the carton. I mean, I bought these things so you could buy one diaper. I'm sitting here saying, okay, so where are the grocery stores? Where's the fresh fruits and vegetables to sustain the community and focus on good health? If the houses are so close together and there are no trees and no green space, that's why we sit on the porch, to get out of the house. There's nowhere to go if you're on quarantine. You can't go and exercise. You can't go and take a walk. What you do is you have people fighting for limited resources, and then you wonder why the communities are in the state that they are. If you only give a certain number of items to a community and everyone has to fight over it, this is what you end up with. Is it time for a revolution? Black Americans make up, as you know, 13.1 to 14% of the population. Someone asked me, why do I say 13.1 to 14%? Because when they say Black Americans, they include underneath that folks that have come here from the continent, folks that have come here from South America, folks that have come here from, you know, Canada, Black folks under that banner writ large. When I talk about Black folks, I'm talking about those of us who've been here since 1619, who fought to a war from 1863 to 1865, and then we struggled through sharecropping, and then we struggled through Jim Crow, and then we struggled through the Civil Rights Movement, and then we struggled through Black Lives Matter, and then we struggled while Barack Obama was president, and here we are today. I'm talking about those Black folks making up 13.1. And if you're going to extend to all Black folks, that's 14% of the population. But look, we are killed by police at twice the rate of white Americans. Now, I think if you close your eyes, hear me out. If you close your eyes for a second and you just hear me talking about this, you would think we're talking about the recent shooting of Trayvon Martin. I mean, if you just close your eyes for a second, pretend we're not in a global pandemic. Pretend you haven't been in your house all year. Pretend that you weren't surprised that our mayor opened up and removed restrictions. Pretend that none of that's happening. You would think we're talking about the recent shooting of Tamir Rice. You would think I'm talking about Eric Garner being choked out and saying, I can't breathe on camera. You would think we're talking about Corinne Gaines or Sandra Bland being found in her cell. You would think that it was that time, but it's not. We're in Black Lives Matter 2.0. And Duray McKesson did take a little issue with that. He's like, well, we're still in 1.0. I'm saying, you know what? We had one, Barack Obama. And that when Donald Trump ascended to the high Pearly Gates office, they moved Black Lives Matter off the first page. We moved below the fold. We were buried somewhere in the B section until George Floyd was killed. And all of a sudden, Black Lives Matter moved from the B section back above the fold. That's why I call it Black Lives Matter 2.0. I'm not saying the movement stopped. I'm saying people's attention got back focused on it. We are twice as likely to be killed. Listen to this. This is police killings per million. They've been tracking this very, very closely since 2015. Per millions. White folks make up 60% of the population. There are roughly 197 million white folks in America. Black folks, about 13.1 to 14%, but it's roughly about 42 million black folks in this country. Hispanic folks, what I usually call brown folks, who are not white passing because, you know, Hispanic falls under ethnicity, not race, they make up 12% of the population, which is roughly about 39 million people. Other, and I don't mean that in a derogatory term, other, but that's where they put Asian Americans. Unfortunately, the data we have from Vox, which I take issue with a little bit, does not delineate what the other means. Because I do think it's important that to note that they are not counting our indigenous brothers and sisters in their own category. The people who originally had their land, they're not counted in this Vox. This graph. I just want to be clear about that. Asian Americans are not delineated in this graph. They just have it under other. But that's about 49 million people. Here are police killings per million. And this piece that Vox quotes was actually originally published in the Washington Post. Okay, so and people like stopped and said, you're getting all the news from Vox. No, no. It's a piece that Vox quoted coming from the Washington Post based upon research that was done by sociologists. Washington Post is not doing research here. They're grabbing the research and they're publishing it. Per million for killing since 2015. White folks at this point account for 18% of the police killings. That's about 14 million people, 18%. Black folks account for 44% of the police. 35 million, I want us to be clear. That is, what we're talking about is police killings per million since 2015. Hispanic folks account for 33% of the killings by the police. That's about 26 million. And others, about 6% or 5 million. Why is this important? I want us to compare the data from the first graph to the data from the second graph so we can understand what this means. If white folks make up 60% of the population, but yet they only make up 14% of the killings, that to me, that's what it should be in a normal society, right? That's what it should be. You make up 197 million people, you account for 14 million deaths, 18% of the population. This is where it gets confusing. We make up 13 to 14% of the population, but we account for 44% of the killings in this country. I want us to really sit with that for a second. We are being disproportionately killed by police officers in this country. Now on that panel that I mentioned, they were talking about, well, let's not conflate justified police killings with unjustified police killings, right? I mean, we were, T.J. Smith was on this, and he was talking about this. So with some police killings, they're justified in terms of what's happening. Duray McKesson pushed back, which I really appreciate. So you know what? How about let's say none of it's justified. How do we police in such a way that bodies aren't dropping at the end? How do we do that? How do we blow it all up so that we can talk about how we can go forward? Because until black folks can walk safely in this country and not end up in jail, as the young brother did in Texas for walking in the snow, until policing, which has its history in the patty rollers and slavery, until that changes, how do we go forward? We cannot. We got to blow it up. And Dr. Lawrence Brown said what we do. This is what he suggested. And this is the question around, is it time for a revolution? He said that at 11:59 p.m., listen to me, we completely disband the police. 11:59 p.m., all the police officers, Baltimore City, we fire all of them at 11:59 p.m., which means we get rid of all police and we get rid of the all-powerful police union. No more conversation about the consent decree, which, by the way, all that's being discussed even in Annapolis still. All police are gone at 11:59 p.m. Dr. Brown then said at 12:01 a.m., give us a minute to kind of situate ourselves, right? You do a purge for a minute from 11:59 to 12:01. At 12:01 a.m., we hire back police officers who are interested not in policing, but in peacekeeping. We set up Baltimore Peacekeepers, where we look to take the money, which, again, we put, what, four times as much money into policing than we do in schools, take that money and reallocate it. So that way, if my, you know, my aunt's having a psychotic break, I don't dial 911. I dial 511 or 711 or 811. I don't know what the number would be. I dial a different number. And so instead of the cops showing up, guns blazing for my aunt having a psychotic break, instead, social workers show up. If my kid is acting up, I don't know what to do about little Rashad, I don't dial 911 because I don't want the cops coming in here, guns blazing. I really just want some help with my child. So instead of the cops showing up, we send in social workers who can help out. And if my uncle's really sick and I don't know what's going on, I'm a little bit afraid, I don't dial 911, right? No, send in some mental health care workers, that we reallocate the funds. That in school, if little Justina's in my eighth grade class and she's acting up, I'm not going to call the cops on an eighth grader. But maybe there are folks in place who work with young people who can provide counseling and support. We reallocate the funds. That's what we're talking about. Is it time for a revolution? Here we are counting down 28 days of blackness. And if you remember our theme, our goal for Black History Month here on Today with Dr. K, we call it Rebirth of a New Nation. What would it look like for us to get to the other side of Black History Month? And we're looking to do something different. Can you imagine, just with me, getting rid of the police and replacing policing with peacekeepers? Still have authority. I'm not saying we want to have people walk in without being able to protect themselves or protect communities. No. I'm saying, is there a way that we can rethink policing so that we don't continue to have this contentious relationship and we don't continue to have what just happened in Texas, where a young brother out minding his business, walking in a snowstorm, end up spending the night in jail. He was arrested for walking in a snowstorm. Now, he's going to have a lawsuit. I have no doubt that he'll probably win. That's beside the point. The point of the matter is, we will never be free. We, you and I, and I'm talking we collectively, everybody, white, black, Hispanic, Asian American, indigenous, we will never be free individually until we are all free collectively. Is it time for a revolution? This is Today with Dr. K. I'm Dr. K. Wise Whitehead. Let's talk about it more after the break. So, what we're talking about is a revolution. That's what we're talking about. Possibly finding a way to bring about freedom and justice, maybe some restorative justice for Black folks in this country. Here's something that we have to think about. Environmental justice as well. 410-319-8888. Is it time for a revolution? And I want to break this up. So I brought up policing. Yeah, we should blow that up. There's got to be another way we can do policing in this country that is rooted more in equity, that's rooted more in police officers being trained to treat everyone the same. And that means doing diversity training. If you've been socialized in America, yeah, you're probably racist, right? So we're going to have to do some hardcore learning, and I would say from two levels. Hear me out. We need to do some diversity training. If we're talking about a revolution, we got to do top down, right? So I'm saying all those politicians that are racist, that are classist, that are sexist, that are bigots, that are xenophobic, all of them need to be removed. So Ted Cruz, hey, you gotta go, right? I said, Mitch McConnell, hey, boot, you've seen better days. Like, let's get them out of there. Because how can you make laws that will benefit all of us if you don't even see or recognize or value all of us? Top down. That means that last Jim Crow generation, and those are the folks who came of age during Jim Crow. My daddy's part of the last Jim Crow generation. I think he's 76. That last Jim Crow generation, and by the way, a bulk of the white folks in the last Jim Crow generation, more than 50%, I think it's in the 70 percentile, voted for Donald Trump. That last Jim Crow generation, we got to do some training with them. We've got to train them. We got to write them off. I mean, it's only one or two ways we can go, right? Either the last Jim Crow generation will get on board with the train that's moving to justice, or we're going to have to say, you know what, we can't save them. And instead, focus our training on everyone coming down. So those are the boomers. Generation Xers are out in the workforce now. They're in their late 40s, 50s. Hey, they can get training at work. Like, we can do training at work. And the Generation Xers, y'all know better. Let's train them. Millennials, like, top down millennials, like, let's get some training. They're new on the job market. They should already be in diversity training. Millennials were involved in Black Lives Matter. They're probably already steeped in the work and doing the hard work. And then we do bottom-up approach, which means we look at community work, and we look at K-12 and college. K-12 is kindergarten through 12th grade, and 13-16, which is college. Putting it into the curriculum, why not help the next generation to move through some of the racist blocks that we are still dealing with? We are the problem. We want to wonder why young people get all twisted. It's because we are training them that way. We do a bottom-up approach and a top-down approach with the fact that they will meet in the middle. If we're talking about a revolution, we're talking about blowing it all up. Here's three, and then I'm going to go to your calls. 410-319-8888. I dealt with policing. I dealt with this whole idea of education. Now I want to talk about the environment. See, here's the problem. If you live in economically challenged communities, there's a term, and it's not my term, but it was used by someone. It's called segronomics, and it's about how economics and segregation went hand in hand, segronomics. So it's not just about Black folks being outside of the room where it happens. It's about a specific class of Black folks being outside the room. If you are middle and upper class here in Baltimore City, you are in the room where it happens. I'm just saying. If you're an elected official here in Baltimore City and you're Black, you're not outside the room. I mean, our mayor is Black. Our state's attorney is Black. The CEO of schools is a Black woman. I'm just saying. We have a number of Black city council folks. We have Black principals in this city. We have Black business owners in this city. They are not outside of the room where it happens. Here in Baltimore, we're really talking about segronomics, which is about the ways in which Black, economically challenged Black folks, Black economically challenged put those things together. That particular group of black folks are outside the room where it happens. And as such, they are in the midst of environmental racism, where there's lead in the water, lead in the paint in their homes, lead in the soil. And of course, lead poisoning leads to things like what? Aggressiveness, impulsivity, where you have no impulse control. It leads to assertiveness. It takes away your cognitive developmental skills. All of that starts as early as the womb with economically challenged black women who are pregnant, who start behind with less access to prenatal care and prenatal vitamins, less access to being able to lay down and rest and kick up their feet, less access to fresh fruits and vegetables, so their children that are born behind. And then they drink water that has lead in it. They're washing their hands with lead-based water. They're crawling around the floor, maybe picking up lead-based paint, as Freddie Gray and his sister did. To blow it all up, what Dr. Lawrence Brown said in his book, The Black Butterfly, Baltimore City needs to put down a $3 billion grant, reparations, black neighborhood reparations. With the $3 billion, take $1.5 billion of that and get rid of the lead so that not this generation, listen to me, not the next generation, but the generation after that. What I said, the children of my children could benefit. So the children that are alive today, that are in middle school, high school, on their way to college, or on their way to career, they're not going to benefit. They've already been lead poisoned. We're talking about the generation that comes after that. Think about it. The children of my children could benefit from the changes. Is it time for a revolution? 410-319-8888. I have Leo Burros on the phone kicking us off first. Leo, how are you, sir?
Dr. K. Wise Whitehead, I'm wonderful, and you're wonderful as always because you're agitating correctly. You're stimulating us to think, and that's so meaningful. I would simply say that when you're talking about, you kind of slanted this toward the police, but you're talking about many things. We're challenged economically. I would say 70%, and correct me if I'm in error, but a round figure of 70% of African Americans, or I call us black African Americans, are poor in the economic scheme of things. Now, others will argue with that, but I'm saying what we do for the collective serves us all well if those of us who have resources, economic empowerment, or have wealth will bend our hearts and do more as mentors to help the other brothers and sisters come up the ladder of economic success. I'm looking at the need for black people to become independent voters. Forget about the Republicans and Democrats if we're talking about revolution. Broker your vote. Eliminate the Electoral College system. Reparations, define it. I'll start off with demanding an executive order from the President of the United States eliminating student loan debt in this country.
Come on.
Civics is important, and I'm going to put in context of what you said in the civics arena. Yes, our schools should teach it, but our schools have been programmed not to teach remedies, common sense remedies, that are going to work for us because genocide is still the reality. And lastly, law enforcement officers' Bill of Rights in the state of Maryland. Maryland was the first state to enact the law enforcement officers' Bill of Rights, which I believe should be repealed and eliminated. That occurred in 1974. With the Jewish governor, Marvin Mandel. And now we have Sergeant Frank Mancuso, who's the president of the Fraternal Order of Police, Lodge Number 3 in this city. He spends most of his time, though he derives his income from this city, he spends most of his time attacking the black police commissioner, the black mayor, and black people in general. And so, yeah, we're past due for a revolution. We're overdue, and if we don't get people to speak out, go on, be unafraid. You're not just an armchair revolutionary on the internet. You have to throw down the gauntlet and say, this is what we want, this is what we demand, and if you don't do what we say to ensure our survival, we're going to get you out of office by any means necessary. Mm. Is that extreme? I don't think so.
I don't think so. If we're talking about saving our community, it's not extreme.
Well, we've got to stand, and our problem is that we've been cowed into not standing, and it, to the extent that we have a backbone or spine is indicative of our, to ensure that we're going to continue to survive, because the plan is to kill us. And when a police officer approaches you with a gun in his hand to stop you for a traffic violation, he doesn't care what you call yourself, whether you're a Moor, Black, or Negro. He's just going to kill you.
Let's talk about naming them. You're right.
In all likelihood, we're going to get killed irrespective of what we call ourselves. So we got to stop that foolishness about talking about what we call ourselves and simply understand that we have a common enemy.
Okay, I appreciate you. Thank you so much. So folks, before I go on to the next call, let me just put some things down to kind of flush out what Brother Leo was saying. When we talk about poverty rate in this country, listen to me. African Americans, Black folks, we have the highest poverty rate in this country. 27.4% is the poverty rate in the Black community. In the Hispanic community, it's 26.6%. In the white community, it's 9.9%. In terms of children who live in poverty, 14.5% of white children live in poverty. 14.5%. I want you to compare that to 45.8% of Black children in this country live in poverty. Almost half of the Black children 18 and under in this country live in poverty in the Black community. Poverty level wages, and this is why Maryland has to think for a second, right? Because they estimate that poverty level wages, it is $11.06 or less an hour. If you make less than $11.06 an hour, according to the census, breakdown around wealth inequity and wage equity, you are making poverty wages, $11.06 per hour. Understand, Maryland was 1010 for a long time, right? It wasn't until December of 2020, just a couple of few small number of months ago, we are making $11.75 an hour. Maryland just got above paying poverty level wages. If you're trying to figure out where you are, if you make less than $11.06 an hour, you're making poverty level wages. We're up 69 cents in here, so we're at $11.75. When you look at the breakdown in our community, 27.3% of the Black community makes between $25,000 and $50,000 a year. 27.3%. These figures are as of the end of 2018. 15.2% of the population make between $50,000 to $75,000 a year. So 15% of the Black folks are making between $50,000 to $75,000 a year, which is considered to be middle class. 7.6% of the population are making between $75,000 and $100,000 a year. $75,000 to $100,000. It's only 7.6% of the population. 9.4% of the population of 42 million Black folks in this country make more than $100,000 a year. 9.4%. So if you're making 100K, you are in what we call the elite of the elite when it comes to income levels in the black community. And granted, folks, these figures don't even take into account what happened last year when the black community was devastated and decimated by COVID-19. We are so behind. We're not the only community, but we started so far behind that imagine how far we have fallen with 1 year of a global pandemic being mismanaged by a man who I would consider to be a sociopath, which means he had no care, no consideration, no feelings of humanity at all for anybody other than himself and his family. And we end up with this bungled pandemic that devastated our community. You may have gotten your second stimulus check, which might have been, what, $600 or something? The first one was $1,200. There are a number of nations that paid their residents, their citizens, their loved community, extended community. They gave them stimulus checks every month. We got two, maybe. One was for $1,200 or so. One was for $600 or so. And now we're waiting, begging, hoping, scraping, standing by that Biden and Kamala Harris will do their job and take care of the citizenry. I mean, we're not asking them for handouts. We're asking them to do their job, which is why they said when you get to the end of this pandemic, they're roughly estimating that 3 out of every 5 black businesses will close. 410-319-8888. Is it time for a revolution? And if so, what does that look like for you? Clarence is on the phone from Baltimore. Clarence, how are you?
Hey, I'm fine, Dr. K. Hey, Dr. K, respectfully to you and what I'm about to say, because this might step on some people's toes.
Go ahead, step.
When you opened your shows, the show, all of the questions you were asking in Baltimore City, and I'm going to localize this to Baltimore City, those questions need to be asked of specifically, and I point out to the black folks on the Baltimore City Development Corporation that, and almost the most people who are awake, woke in Baltimore City understand that that's the power structure in the city. There's no question about that. Because once Dr. Todd Yering said to me, well, in order to effect the change and know what's going on, you've got to be in the room. And I looked, I heard you, when he said that, I was saying, well, like, look at who's in the room. Your boss is in the room. Calvin Butler's in the room. A whole bunch of very influential black folks are in the room in the Baltimore City Development Corporation. But you will never get them all on a stage like a town hall meeting and ask those very same questions that you just asked your audience today, because they won't touch it. Because what has, and I'm pointing out Dr. Yering, what has black folks being in the room of the Baltimore City Development Corporation done for folks in Baltimore City? The police department are not the culprits in economic disparities in Baltimore City or the fire department. When the Baltimore City Council acts as front men or front women for the Baltimore City Development Corporation with an economic decision, what goes where, when, and how, and then it's filtered down to us as, you know, a conversation or through the news media with a bunch of subterfuge mixed in it to mislead and misguide black folks in this city as to what is really happening. For instance, all the money that came into Baltimore City during the Freddie Gray incident, what happened to it? Well, I bet you the Baltimore City Development and a lot of 300, entrepreneurs, the I'm looking for that word. I'm trying to be fast, Dr. K, but you right. know, the people who do the charity works in Baltimore City,
right.
they know what happened to it, but we don't. So when you want to ask those kind of questions, you know, you have to ask the power structure, but the power structure remains behind the scene, hidden. And as far as structural change, Dr. K, in this country, we had the opportunity to have structural change. We did not want structural change because we were put in a position to be so fearful of a Donald Trump. When I truly believe that all of those people that voted for Donald Trump aren't crazy. Maybe a lot of them are, but not all of them. And it doesn't equate to 79 million of them all nutty that would run and want to storm the Capitol. I don't believe that. But if you had put your effort in, your same effort into explaining and critiquing what Bernie Sanders was talking about, and not just throwing the scare tactic in it, oh, socialism, that you could have defeated Donald Trump and the country would have been in a different direction than a much been in a much better place. Now, maybe I'm naive, but you put the effort into maintaining the old system, which you're talking about having a revolution against. It, you know, I don't get it, Dr. K. You know, I'm sorry. That's great. Thanks for taking the call.
No problem. No, I'm letting you play. You know what, folks? Here's the thing. And I appreciate Clarence. Okay. So just to break down what he said, I think that it's easier to talk about how we have failed. It is. I mean, I could sit here and I can do a show a day talking about how we have failed and how we haven't done enough and how we have so far to go. It's easy to do that. I think the hard part is making a decision to say, okay, so we're not going to fail forward. We instead are going to succeed forward. And I'm coining that term right now. Go ahead and write it down, Justina. Fail forward. That is, when you hear it, tell people that's Dr. K's term. We're not going to fail forward. In other words, we're not going to sit here and say, even before we do it, that we're going to fail. I don't like starting from that. And I think if you're a parent, like I am, I always tell my sons that it's impossible until somebody does it. It was impossible to send someone to the moon until somebody, black women, mapped it out and made it possible. It was impossible for us to have a, you know, have do open heart surgery until a black man made it possible. It was impossible to get cars to stop at the corner, right, until a black man developed the stoplight. It was impossible for us to iron our clothes until a black woman developed the iron. It was impossible for us to straighten up our hair until a sister, Madam C.J. Walker, did it. It's impossible for a black man to win the Nobel Peace Prize until Dr. King did it. It was impossible for a black woman to run from slavery to freedom and keep coming back and taking other people with her. It was impossible until Harriet Tubman did it. It's always impossible until somebody does it. I tell my sons, start with the possible. There you go. Let's assume that you're going to be successful. So let's plan for the other side of success. You don't think you're going to get, I was dealing with my son, some of you are dealing with this, when my son was applying to school and he was doing his early decision and he wanted to go to a baby Ivy. I said, okay, start with the possible. Let's just start with you're going to get in. So now let's plan ahead from that. And if you don't get in, it's not because you didn't do everything that you are supposed to do, but you will always, to, you know, paraphrase Michael Jordan, right? You will always miss 100% of the shots you never take. So we can sit here and say, well, black folks, we've always failed. We've always not made it. We've always been in the room. We can do that. Or we can say, you know what, we're not going to fail forward. Why can't we say here in 2021, while our community is being decimated and devastated by COVID-19, by economic oppression, by systemic inequality, by the lack of goods and resources into our community, let's say, you know what, we're not going to fail forward. We can be the ones, just like every generation that brought change before us, to bring about a change. I think sometimes we forget, in my opinion, 410-319-8888. I think sometimes we forget that what Frederick Douglass said, right? That struggle, progress, right? Progress never concedes without a struggle. Never has, it never will. That's what Frederick Douglass said, which means, why do we think that this country's going to change unless we are willing to change it? Why don't we accept the fact, and this is the part you're not going to like, that some of us are going to die on the way? Ooh, that sounds horrible for the radio, right? It does. I'm being honest. Here, this is what my daddy said. When they were coming through the civil rights movement, he said they were very clear. Some of us are going to die. Some of us are. Some of us are going to go to jail for a long time. Some of us are going to be beat down. Some of us are going to lose everything. Some of us are going to be run out of town. Some of us are going to lose their job. Some of us are never going to have money. Some of us are not going to be able to settle down and just have a family and live our life. Some of us aren't going to allow that to happen. Some of us may not ever be able to have that. But we fight anyway. We fight because we want to make sure that the generation that comes after us doesn't have to have this struggle. I say that because I sit here on the campus of Morgan State University. I sit here knowing I can go in any restaurant in this country. I can go through Baltimore City. Now, I don't have money to go into the restaurants, but I could go in there. I sit here knowing if I had to catch the bus in any part of this country, I'm not getting on the back of the bus. I know I'm never going to go in an alley and order my food. Why? Because my father's generation said some of us aren't going to make it home. And you know what, Emmett Till? You know what, Medgar Evers? You know what, Malcolm X? You know what, Dr. King? Some of us didn't make it home. Some of us didn't. And they sacrificed for us. So why don't we say, you know what? Some of us ain't gonna make it. But why don't we try anyway? Why don't we do it anyway for the children of our children? Let me go to Linda before we go to break. Linda, how are you?
Hey, Dr. K, how are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for calling, Linda.
I just want to say God bless to you and all of the people out there. And you know what? The subject should be enough is enough. And we, like you said, we could sit back and talk about how we have failed in doing this, how we could have did this or should have did that. But, baby, God gave me a message, and I shared it with the people. Forget, focus, and fulfill.
Okay, thank you very much. Forget, focus, and fulfill. We'll hold it there. Come back after the break. Let's talk some more about what happened in Texas, y'all, when we return.